Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm chairman of the Natural Gas Programme at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Robin Baker, who's a visiting research fellow at the OIES, to discuss the key messages that came from his recent paper, LNG Finance Will Lend Us Accommodate the Changing Environment, that was published in November 2020. Robin, lovely to see you here.
Hello. Thank you, David.
Now, Robin, why don't we start by asking, you know, a simple question. Why did you decide to write this paper at this time?
Well, good question. Like you, I've been interested in the transition for a long time that LNG is going through from its classic model to a more market-based model. But to date, it hasn't had much impact on finance. That is all going to change. We're seeing the COVID crisis has created weak demand, which I think is accelerating this transition. And on top of that, I think there is more uncertainty in the industry, perhaps than there's ever have been, with the long-term future uncertain due to the necessary changes resulting from climate change.
Now, because you mentioned, you know, market and other uncertainties. You know, why is uncertainty so important to lenders?
Well, uncertainty is important to everyone, to companies and investors, equity investors as well. But uncertainty is two-sided risk to them. They benefit from the upside as well as the downside. That's not the case for lenders. Lenders are in the business, their business model is lending other people's money, which has to be repaid under all circumstances. And they're using that to apply to projects, which will only get repaid if the project succeeds. They don't benefit from the upside.
Right. So it's a one-sided risk, you're saying. So therefore, uncertainty is key in pricing and all of that that the lenders are offering.
That's right. And it feeds into their cost structure quite directly, because lenders have to assess that because of that risk, they have to put equity capital as well as debt. And so they lend less than they're borrowing. That equity capital is expensive. The more risk, the more equity capital is needed.
Well, look, you say in the opening of your paper, limited recourse project finance has strongly supported the LNG industry over 35 years, funding around 40% of the total capital for all major liquefaction projects. So, now, why have so many LNG liquefaction projects be funded by project finance?
Yes, it is high. It used to be even higher, in fact. It used to be over 50% for a time. There are a number of reasons, but I would say the biggest one is in many projects, there is at least one sponsor who actually would find it hard to raise the finance otherwise. It's not always appreciated that there aren't that many different sources of debt finance for long-term business. Banks generally don't lend long-term other than on a secured basis. That might be a security in a fixed asset, like a mortgage. But without some sort of security like that, banks don't lend more than 10 years, generally not more than 8. So for long-term projects, there's really only two major sources of debt from project finance or from the debt, public debt capital markets or bond markets. Those are the two main sources.
But I imagine, has the situation got worse with the liquidity crisis that we've seen in the industry over the last 10, 15 years?
I don't think it's got materially worse with the liquidity crisis. It got more expensive. But where a lot of people thought that the availability of capital was going to dry up, it never has done. There is a lot of funds available from pension insurance companies looking for long-term secure investments. The money is there. The question is the structure and the price and the risk.
Interesting. So another thing you say in your paper is the importance of shareholding and the sponsors to a project. You know, so tell me, why are these important when you are determining a finance structure?
They're important because lenders are not the experts in the energy industry. They rely on the experts in the industry to properly manage the projects. Particularly when you're looking for a project with repayment over a 10 to 20 year period, lenders want to know that there is strong, competent people able to develop and manage the project. And they want to know there's competent buyers who are in a market and got access to that market who will buy the project. They rely heavily on these projects, companies. And I would say one of the tenets of lending is you look at a project, you look at all the counterparties you're relying on, and you ask yourself for each of them, do they really have the ability, first of all, most important, Secondly, do they have an incentive? And thirdly, do they have the obligation, the contract, to do what they say they're going to do? That's how we look at projects.
I must admit, what I like about your paper is that as a banker, you know, unlike many of the listeners to this podcast, you approach the argument from a banker's perspective, which I think is important to hear that kind of point of view. So can we talk about project structures and lenders' approach to risk, which I expect determines that all-important risk-reward balance?
Risk in a project, an LNG project, one of the biggest aspects is the risk to the revenue line, which comes back to the market. The first question is this project really needed? Is it doing something? Is it producing LNG more cheaply than other ways? Because if it's not, even if you've got a contract, it's not going to be sustainable over the long term. Has it got people who are able to lift that LNG, to buy it, and to pay the price they say they're going to pay? Now, the way lenders look at the risk is they will then do their analysis of a base case, and then a lot of cash flow sensitivities as to what can go wrong. It's necessary to look at all the, not every event, but every reasonable likely downside event to assess if that happens, do we still get paid back?
It's interesting you say that about downside events, Robin, because there are people, of course, argue that lenders are too conservative. You know, is it always the downside that the lenders will look at?
Well, because of the nature of it, the risk that lenders take, it rather does have to. And I'm aware of the criticism of lenders that they're often too negative. And sometimes that's the case. But there's also many other cases where I think within the lending community, you can see that perhaps individual people in the banks are very incentivized to do the deal and are possibly taking on too much risk on the grounds that that's something that their successor might have to deal with. So it's not always the case that lenders are too conservative. There have been many instances of them losing large amounts of money for taking on risks they really should not have done.
Nice to hear the bankers thinking of their successors who will be sitting in their desks in the future. Well, why don't we get back to talking about the change in the LNG market you referred to in your opening remarks? Now, how could the move away from the tramline model towards a more merchant market impact on the ability to finance liquefaction projects, do you think?
Well, I think there's a couple of issues that we've talked about in this. One is, as we see the market becoming more market-based, the present contract structure is not really what buyers want. Firstly, the indexation to oil is not really sensible in a true market environment. And you can see in Europe and progressively now in Asia, the projects looking to, instigated largely by the buyers, looking to a more gas market price index. In Europe, I don't see a problem with that. There is a deep market. In Asia, there isn't as yet. There is one beginning around JKM, but it's very thinly traded at today, doesn't have deep liquidity, and lenders are probably dragging their feet a little bit. There's a bit of resistance to that. Now, I believe that that will come. I see no reason why lenders should not accept JKM as the market deepens, and they will do so. They just may be a little bit behind where developers would like them to be. But it will come.
So, Robin, what about the growth of the North American LNG? Now, surely, with such a deep liquid financing market, this must have made financing easier, hasn't it?
Yes, it certainly has. And we've already seen innovative structures developing in the United States because of that depth of market, the range of different financing alternatives available, and indeed the ability to finance and refinance in the market. So it definitely does make it easier in the United States. There is, of course, the question of the commercial models that will be used in the US. And the model that has been used is one of giving the plant a fixed return with the buyer playing a Henry Hub plus price. I'm not sure that market is sustainable for the future. But nevertheless, the financing is available in the US. You're right.
Interesting. Well, look, why don't we kind of examine in a bit more detail the risks of lending to LNG projects? And first of all, let's start with price risk, you know, and you briefly talked about it. So, you know, what is the price risk? How risky is the volatility that we have in the market? What are the bankers' approaches to that?
Price risk is an interesting one. Banks have, and many other lenders, have happily lent against oil price in lots of projects in all around the world. Yet oil price is hugely volatile. And I think the reason is that it's so well used that lenders have got comfortable, at least they think they understand the risks. Whether they do or not is another matter. But they can analyze oil price and say, this is what it's done in the past, this is what it might do. And that's something they've got comfortable with. If you take a new market, they've got to go through that process again. But the process on price risk is always the same. It's look at the industry cycles, look at the volatility, and just do the sums. And that's typically over the life of the project, how low could their prices reasonably be? And secondly, over a shorter term down cycle, how low could they be? And then you need to structure the debt that can accommodate both of those downsides.
Another core risk is, of course, the demand risk, because that's going to directly impact upon the revenue line. Can you perhaps share with us how bankers approach that?
Yes. Demand risk is fundamentally a risk of what's going on in the market you're selling it to, and that requires market analysis. Does the LNG provide a source of energy that is competitive in that market? How is it sold? And all these local domestic factors. But on top of that, it is also a counterparty risk. Again, the lenders are not the experts on this. They take advice. The project itself is probably not the expert on it. The lenders want to see a strong counterparty in that market committing long-term to buy the product, to basically say, I know this market, I will commit to buy it, and I will sell it. So it's a counterparty risk as well as a market risk.
Now, you say in your paper, interestingly, quote, precedence creates resistance to change, but can be overcome if the case is strong enough. Perhaps you could share with our listeners what you actually mean by that, Robin.
Yes, lenders like precedent for a number of reasons, particularly in LNG, because the projects are so big, it requires a lot of different lenders. Some will be more expert than others on the industry, but you've got to be able to bring in, to attract in the less experienced lenders. More so nowadays when banks like to be able to trade their assets to manage their portfolio. You really want assets that you can say, this is a standard LNG deal. Don't worry, you don't need to worry about the details. That's what it is. So the more non-standard elements you've got, the harder that becomes. Now, that said, a lot of projects in the past and continuing do take one or other standard things. And we'll explain to the banking community, it's a super project. It's really strong in every other respect. But this one aspect is totally different. And what you need to show is two things. One is, do you need that different factor? And secondly, can you substantiate it and support it and show that it doesn't adversely affect your risk? And in each case, if you can answer those two questions satisfactorily, you can usually deviate from precedence.
Let's hit kind of put the nail on the head, as we say in English, and ask the million-dollar question that I hear, most project developers asking, and that is, will lenders accept Asian hub gas pricing risk and shorter LNG contracts? You've given us a little insight to that, but is this a yes or no answer?
Right, it's both. On the first question, on your first question, it's yes. Lenders will accept JKM price risk, and I see this happening relatively soon, perhaps as a percentage of their offtake to start with, which will increase as the market deepens. But yes, they will accept JKM risk. Now, your second question is more difficult. The simple answer is no, maybe in some respects. At the moment, most SPAs are 20-year terms from completion. I don't know that you need 20 years, and I suspect buyers will be resisting. I've seen recent contracts at 10 years, for example. Provided the tenor covers the debt, I would say that will become acceptable, perhaps within a couple of years after debt repayment. Perhaps you don't need 100% offtake to cover the debt. So you could then imagine a mix of contracts. But where I struggle is, I don't see a major greenfield project being developed and financed without sufficient long-term contracts to repay the debt. And that may not be what developers want to hear, because buyers will push against that, but I believe that's the case. I would also, David, just perhaps bounce one question back, which is, will developers really accept this risk? Aside from portfolio players who will treat it a different way, I'm not sure that a developer pursuing a project which is perhaps as big or bigger than his own company is going to put those amount of dollars on the table without some long-term offtake agreements.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, people always point the finger at the lenders. And of course, when we use this expression lenders, don't we? But it covers a lot of banks. It's commercial banks, it's export credit agencies, you know, it's even aid agencies. And of course, many of those are far more conservative than other lenders. So we put it in one bucket, but it's not really one bucket, is it?
It's not, although I would say the majority of, outside the United States, almost all of the debt finance has come from two main commercial banks and export credit agencies. And they started off rather different in their credit approach. They've converged to be very, very similar in their credit approach.
Robin, in your paper, you actually discuss three possible outcomes, or should we call scenarios, you know, of what's going to happen in finance. Can you perhaps share these with the listeners?
Yes. Well, the first is just retention of the existing model. And I believe that it's not completely dead, that buyers will still require a percentage of their demand met by long-term contracts. Secondly is aggregation. And we're already seeing some of the major players acting as portfolio players. We're starting to see in the US as well some refinancing based on aggregation of projects. And I think we'll see more of that. And then thirdly is this question of, well, can we rely on the market? I think this is the one that is far more challenging. It could happen in some circumstances, perhaps particularly starting with expansion projects where you know, the gas is already flowing. There's a track record of sales into an existing market. But that is by far the most challenging of the three.
Can I take the conversation in another direction that you raise in your paper? And that is another key point that's being addressed by lenders. And of course, that is climate change. You know, let's be clear also that the industry has been addressing this for some time. You know, in fact, the Equator Principles were launched, I think, in Washington, D.C. back in June 2003. And the fourth review, which was adopted by 38 supporting countries in November last year, you know, has updated that considerably. So can you perhaps tell us, how are lenders approaching the issue of climate change and energy transition?
With great concern. Lenders are acutely aware of climate change and the public and pressure group efforts to get them, in fact, to cease lending to projects which are seen as environmentally harmful in any way, and in some circumstances, getting them to cease lending to any fossil fuel project. Most project finance banks have ceased lending to coal. The pressure is on for gas and oil. The challenge will be to demonstrate, as we believe, that there is a very strong case for gas within a proper climate change scenario. I think lenders and very much the industry has a lot more to do to demonstrate sustainability. And this, I think, is going to be a big area of focus, the due diligence process. Why is this project environmentally sound?
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, we could have the same conversation in other sectors of the energy business, you know, talking about gas contract as well. It's providing that kind of evidence, isn't it, really? But let's ask a wider question. You know, we talked about LNG and gas projects. Okay, but what about looking at another sector, the financing of power projects? You know, do they face the same challenges as the gas and the LNG sectors?
Somewhat different. Power project finance has been a major part of project finance globally. But it's done on a different structure with secure contracts providing a certain revenue stream. The reason is power is a conversion process where the market risk is the spread, price spread between fuel supply price and power project prices. That spread can and does at times fall to zero. So it's a difficult risk to take. And you may see a connection there between the comments I made about US LNG projects, which actually are profiting from the spread between market prices in some domestic market in Asia or somewhere and their own domestic prices. It's a risky business.
Okay, and of course, the other area is, you know, what about the financing of renewables projects? You know, again, do they face similar challenges to the gas sector, or are they basically what everybody wants to lend to today?
to some extent, they're what everybody wants to lend to today for two reasons. One is they tend to be well-structured. And secondly, it's obviously burnishes the firm's environmental credentials. They're well-structured because they're generally contractual or regulated, providing, again, a secure revenue stream. It does give you government political risk, but other than that, no, they're very popular.
It did, because of course in the European LNG strategy, it's very clear that it's going to be green LNG or it's going to be carbon neutral, it's going to be a support. So I can understand that renewables projects are going to be where the banks are going to want their funds, isn't it?
Yep, indeed it is. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, look, Robin, we're coming to the end of our podcast, unfortunately, but I always like to end up by looking forward, my kind of usual question when I do podcasts. So what could the end game be? Will there be sufficient financing available to fund the LNG chain? Effectively, I think I'm asking you, should project developers be concerned that the funds may not be there? And if yes, could this lead to a concentration where only creditworthy companies can develop new projects?
I don't think developers should be concerned about the availability of funds. The funds will be there. But more than perhaps ever before, I think they will see the finance community having more of a say in the structuring and the commercial risk profile of projects. That is going to somewhat play to the larger players, but it does not rule out smaller players with their creativity and ability to mover being able to get finance. It just means they'll perhaps see their banks more often.
So they're going to get to know their banker?
Yes, yeah.
Probably though virtually a bit more down computer screens, which is how we're doing this, of course, today, isn't it, Robin? Well, look, Robin, thank you so much for your time. I've really enjoyed our conversation that builds on the messages from your recently published paper, LNG Finance Will Lenders Accommodate the Changing Environment. I hope all our listeners have enjoyed this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.